Welcome to Spiritual Naturalism Today, a conversation on science, nature, and spirituality. Our program is sponsored by the Spiritual Naturalist Society with host Daniel Strain.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Daniel Strain, and I'm here with my co-host, Jay Forrest.
Hello.
Hey, Jay, and want to say hi to everybody. We really appreciate the comments we've been getting, and thank you for following our podcast. Please feel free to join us on the website and check out the comments and all of the other articles. Today, we're going to be talking about God. Our topic today is, does God exist? So I was joking with Jay earlier that we're going to settle this once and for all, right?
He's not optimistic at all.
So I think one of the things, Jay, that I want to start with is I always, when we talk about things like this, I like to throw out a disclaimer. The Spiritual Naturalist Society, even though we are naturalistic, I am pretty proud of the fact that we do not spend time bashing other people's beliefs, or we don't do the religious criticism kind of thing. We focus on, you know, what's going to be useful and helpful to naturalists. And but there are naturalists who have different versions of a God, maybe not in a literal sense. And also it helps people to understand spiritual naturalism, because that is one of the first questions that always arises. Well, do you guys believe in God, and so on and so forth? And there's a lot of really interesting and subtle complexities about that question. So that's what we're talking about today. And we're going to proceed the way that we believe in proceeding, which is putting humility first, and respect for other people and their beliefs. But humility in the sense of none of us has the keys to ultimate truth, and we're just doing the best we can, and we're going to share some of our thoughts about that today. What do you think, Jay?
Well, I think that that's probably the best way to approach it, because you've got so many people. I mean, the first problem, of course, is the word God. I don't think that you can get together a group of people who will agree on what that means. So the word
is... Yeah, when people ask me, do you believe in God, I always say, God who?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's one of those things that, you know, there's just so many definitions. So that's the first issue. The second is, because the idea of God is a metaphysical question, that means it's beyond the physical. It's a question that we can't have a dogmatic answer for. Science will never be able to answer whether or not God exists. It's a question beyond science. And that's where many people, you know, take solace.
But yeah, I think it's a good idea for us to start with that most literal, personified, kind of common understanding of God. And we can branch out from there. And so when we start there, there's definitely, by definition, no possible way to prove or disprove.
Well, and that's what a lot of people do, is they'll start with a very literal definition of God, a transcendent and immanent supernatural being who created the universe. And then as they begin to study science and philosophy and stuff like this, the concept will morph. And some of those hard lines will start softening. And they'll begin to realize, well, maybe it's best not to be quite so dogmatic, and you know, there's evidence over here that seems to contradict that. And so they mess with the definition of God. And I think that's where most people are at, is because the majority of people do believe in a higher power, something greater, you know, and so they start from that. And I believe that everybody has that feeling that there's something bigger, something greater. The problem is when we start defining that. Mm-hmm. We start putting boxes around that. What is that thing, that feeling? What is it corresponding to? It? Is it just in our heads? That's what most atheists would say. It's just in your head. But is it? Is there something that it corresponds to? Is there some reality that we do need to connect to, whether it's nature or the universe or whatever? So it's one of those things that we first have to understand that people who do believe in God are not idiots. They're not stupid. They're not, you know, wrong. And to come at it with more humility aspect, that there are reasons why the majority of people believe this. And be And be respectful of that. Respect that feeling, and yet being able to be critical and use critical thinking in dealing with the concepts that correspond to that feeling.
Because we each are trying to figure out how are we going to proceed as individuals on all of this. So
exactly.
It is important to examine these kinds of things because they directly relate to our practice. So I like the idea of I've been seeing this more and more lately, this going beyond the theism-atheism dichotomy, you know, coming at this in a more subtle, nuanced way. And there's some really great things that can be experienced there. And what you described about starting with this literal version and then the definition starts to morph, what I think I've seen in most people who go through this kind of process is not a weakening of their faith, but actually becoming more and more content in their beliefs as this starts to happen. There might be a rough patches that you have to get through, but oftentimes what you see is that a person's idea of God begins to match up to the most sacred kinds of experience or profound kinds of experiences that they had, instead of just being this story that they had to either buy or reject. I like talking about, what do we mean by God?
I think if you're going to ask the question, does God exist? The first question after that is, what do you mean by God? I think that's, you know, definitions of God is important.
There's certainly, there's a lot of things to consider. Is God immanent or is God outside of the universe, or is God part of the universe, part of the cosmos? Today, we often think of God as outside of that. The supernaturalists will look at it that way. But there, in ancient times, there have been many examples of looking at God as a part of nature, as integrated part of, or as being nature. And then the next question of personal versus impersonal. The personal God, it has a lot of different implications philosophically than an impersonal God. And so when we start to look at things that way, I think that's when we start to move beyond it starts to become harder and harder to just say, yes, I believe in God, or no, I don't. Because some of these subtle definitions of God can have even a atheist by most people's definition saying, well, I accept that. But, then you have the question of, should that word really be used if it's not what most people think? And so we have to be careful that we're not misleading people or dodging an issue, trying to maybe just for politically correct purposes or whatever, we're trying to like avoid an argument or something. And so we say that, and what we really mean is a totally different thing than what they mean. So assuming that we're wanting to be perfectly upfront and honest with other people and not mislead them, it can still be okay, I think, to have different definitions of God. It's just you have to take that extra step of saying, well, I think of God this way or that way.
Yeah, and that is probably one of the difficulties is the categories that you said. For example, you use the word imminent, and some people don't know that immanent means active and involved in the world, and the other opposite of that is transcendent, above and beyond the world.
That was the word I was trying to remember, right, transcendent, yeah.
So you've got those two aspects. There are some that believe that God is completely transcendent, such as deism. Deism believes that God wound the universe, and now he's letting it unwind on its own. In other words, he was involved in creating it, and then wiped his hands of it and walked away. And that was mainly the belief of many of the founding fathers of America,
That's why they talked about nature's law, because they thought the universe was functioning according to natural law from that point on.
Correct, correct.
Which allows all of the Enlightenment science that they, you know, were followers of.
Yeah, the movement of the Renaissance humanism, a lot of the writings of the Greek and Roman philosophers became known for the first time. And so that penetrated their mind. And there was many people like Nietzsche and other philosophers who began questioning the idea of God. So the most respectable position, if you didn't believe in an active involved God in this particular realm, was deism. And so that's why many of them chose deism as the respectable alternative. Because atheism, even back in the founding of the United States, was considered, you know, appalling. If you were an atheist, you were blacklisted.
And it was kind of synonymous with bad person.
Yeah, exactly. And in many minds, it still is. I mean, many people still, of all the people they would elect, you know, a criminal before they would elect an atheist. You know, it's one of those things that still, there's stigma still involved in that word.
I think it's starting to shift as the demographics of America starts to shift. I think Bernie Sanders had an answer about his religion that I can't remember the exact wording now, but it was something that would have been surprising 20 years ago. And there's also, I think, as people look at ethics and they start to see that there's a lot of different reasons why a person would be good than just theism.
Right.
You know, we're starting to see some changing there.
Yeah, a lot of people have a hard time with the idea, how can you be good without God? Because they say God is the foundation of morality. And yet, is it right because God wills it? Or does God will it because it's right?
And once again, we're back to Socrates.
And the thing is, if it's right because God wills it, then God can change it. And then there's nothing objectively right or wrong. It's subjective to that particular God. And if God says it's right because it's already right, then it's not grounded in God. It's grounded in something else.
I always thought it was kind of ironic that, you know, I felt like it was theism that had the subjective ethics. And whereas my naturalistic views, I felt, were the objective ethics, because there you could base an argument, an ethical argument, on results, on outcome to human happiness. And you could talk about statistics and studies, and you could talk about psychology, and you could reference a common point of reference that other people could verify. Whereas if you say, you know, my ethics comes from this source that I can't prove or disprove, then it's subjective in the sense that everybody has their own beliefs about what that being would say. So it's kind of like the exact opposite to me. It feels like the exact opposite in terms of subjectivity of ethics.
Yeah, yeah, because if it's determined upon the whim of a supernatural being that we may or may not know how he currently feels, then... Mm-hmm. I mean, it's literally...
Not to mention that our flawed understanding or belief about that, what that being says.
Right. And the fact that they're, I mean, which holy book are you going to follow? You know, there's so many out there, that which one is the correct one? I think, though, that if we look at, as far as morality is concerned, I think the basic, the golden rule, do unto others as you have them do, or what Confucius said 500 years before Christ, don't do unto others what you don't want done unto you. I think that you can find that in all the religions. And in order for that to be the case, it doesn't have to come from a god. It didn't come from Zeus then. It didn't come from, you know, the different gods. It's something that's innate within us. It's something that we know from being human and being connected with the natural world.
It has to do with the nature of being, what it is to be a human being. And
exactly.
For us all to get along and be happy and things to work out.
Right, exactly.
So you mentioned earlier the Founding Fathers going back to the ancient Greeks and everything, and I'm sure anybody who's listened to several of our episodes will know we're going to bound to end up in those areas. I'm going to talk about Stoicism, but I'd like to I'd like to share a little bit of kind of an interesting interplay that I came across between East and West, and it helped me kind of look at the theism, atheism thing in a different way. And it's one of those things that I was talking about that's kind of, you know, beyond the simple dichotomy. And it has to do with the combination of two different concepts. In the Western side, on the Stoic side, the Stoics looked at Zeus as the soul of the cosmos. And so not really this being that's outside the cosmos, outside the universe, but you've got the universe acting according to the logos, what we would call natural law or the laws of physics today. And out of that activity comes Zeus. Zeus is the part of and emerges out of nature and is also the thing that's governing everything, right? Whether you look at Zeus as a personal or impersonal force or concept. But nevertheless, they said, okay, well, there's the cosmos, there's the physical movements of this, and then Zeus is the soul of the cosmos. Just like if the cosmos was your body, Zeus would be the soul of that body. And so we're a spark of that. But you have to understand the word soul, the way soul was understood pre-Christianity. And for that, you can look at Socrates in the book of Phaedo talking to others about the nature of the soul. And it's very clear in their discussions that what they're talking about is what we call today the mind, how the mind works. They're not talking about a disembodied ghost. They're talking about the nature of our personhood. And so we say today that there is a distinction between a body and a person. Even a naturalist says, well, there's a person that is a different concept. It's not this other kind of substance that science has yet to prove. It's just the result of all the activity of our brain operating as a person. Like you could say a nation, but you can't put a nation on a scale or see the concept of nation disembodied from any one particular nation. So, that's how they looked at soul. And so when you talk about the soul of the cosmos, you're really talking about the same kind of distinction you're talking about between a person's body and the person, the mind. And so on the Western side, you've got this concept of the soul of the cosmos. And on the Eastern side, you've got the concept of no self in Buddhism. And more broadly speaking, the concept of emptiness in Buddhism, which is that our concept of the self is really an illusion, because the self is really a series of aggregates, just a whole bunch of collection of different aggregates, your sensations and memories and sensory inputs, and all of these different aggregates come together and interplay to create this illusion of the self. And we imagine the self to be this unchanging, ongoing thing, you know, whereas Buddhism says that's a delusion. You know, the self is just kind of the collection of these aggregates. So if you combine that concept of the no self with the concept of Zeus as the soul of the universe, then it starts to become apparent that the question of whether or not I exist as a self and whether or not God exists are kind of the same question. They're just on different scales. One is a complex system that's this one biological organism, and the other is the complex system that is all of the universe, all of the natural universe. And so the Stoics answer that by dividing things between what exists and what subsists. Existing reality was composed of those things that exist and those things that subsist. And subsist are those things that subsist on the interaction and relationships of the existing things. But so you could say God is as real as I am, but the question is, am I real as an entity, as a person that stands apart from the body? And naturalists, of course, look at that as an emergent property. So there could be this emergent property from all of the universe that is the general character of how the cosmos works, and it governs how the cosmos works, like the laws of physics. It doesn't necessarily have to be personal or personified. Anyway, I kind of, you can go in a lot of directions with that, but I wanted to bring up that kind of interesting interplay between the no self and a person, personhood.
Yeah, and that's one of the difficulties too when you start getting into words, is words have connotations that people within their particular culture understand. I think the only difficulty that I have with the Stoic understanding is the idea of providence, that this logos is somehow looking out for us. The universe is a hostile place. I don't think there's any proof of any benevolent. I think if we go back to the natural laws and interpret that way, it's the best way to do it.
Yeah, I think that a lot of modern Stoics don't really go with providence. But having said that, there is a version of providence that's not about the purposes being in our best interests, just that there is a reason why these things happen, which is just another way of saying there's cause and effect.
Yeah, and that's a semantic, because the word providence actually means caretaking. And so you could interpret as caretaking for itself, you know, but to me, it's one of those,
the universe.
Yeah.
And then that includes hurricanes and the fact that we need to go away and make room for other people.
It would be really hard for me to call that caretaking.
Well, I mean, if you were a blade of grass and you had to be cut in the garden.
Yeah, but we interpret the world from our perspective. And from our perspective, I think it would be fair to say that there is no evidence of providence in that sense. But I think also that's one of our problems, is we are very human-centered, very, I mean, even with the idea of God. To me, God was one of those things that combined a number of things. And I've wrote this on the Spiritual Naturalist site. The very attributes that are attributed to a supernatural being, are there most of those attributes can be attributed to nature, to the universe. Mm-hmm. But there was not, that's not God. God is not just the attributes of the universe attributed to some personal being. It's also, and this you can see from even within Christianity, it's taking our ideals and our level of morality and projecting it onto this entity. You'll see in the Old Testament, it was fine to kill out a nation. It was fine to and God even commanded them to go into these nations and kill every man, woman, child, baby in the womb. Take the sword and kill it.
Yeah.
And yet in the New Testament, we have the God of love, turn the other cheek. So as mankind has progressed in their morality, God has kind of evolved as well to mirror man's own ideals.
You can tell a lot about a people by looking at their God. What does their God say?
The God ideal is a mirror to reflect the society we live in. Many Christians now would consider themselves progressive Christians. They would say that homosexuals have the right to love who they want, even though New Testament and Old Testament would say that's not viable. Yet now morality has gone, and the idea of freedom of choice has developed to the point where we realize, oh wait, the problem is whenever you base yourself on a scripture, you freeze yourself in time. And those that are fundamentalists freeze themselves into the first century AD. They have not progressed. Right. And where progressive Christianity has continued to evolve, has continued to work through the difficulties of society and getting along with one another and war and peace. There's no more such thing as a just war. I mean, war is bad. People die. We see that on the TV. It's horrible.
It seems like what people are, people get afraid of whenever you start talking about scripture or God or religion in this way is they're concerned that, oh, if there's no set thing, then we can just make up anything. We can say it's okay to eat babies, and then we just decide that's the new morality, and then all this terrible stuff will happen. But it doesn't really match what we see in history. What we see in history is that when we've freed up investigation into moral deliberation, we've seen advancement rather than, degradation. Degradation's happening with people all the time in every culture, but those aren't the people who are honestly trying to understand morality or ethics and trying to make advances.
But we also need to understand it's not a straight line. It's more of a spiral.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to have the Stalins, you're going to have the Hitlers. These things are good. But then when that happens, you'll see that we spiral ahead out of those bad areas. We learn from the mistakes of our past. Not
and
always.
We hope more than less.
Yeah. So it's a spiral. I mean, it's not a straight line. There, that you have to take the whole history of mankind to see that there's a progression in morality.
But if you don't have a moral deliberation, if you don't have the ability to
the freedom.
Assess morality, then you're basically just saying it's going to be up to whoever has the most swords.
Yep.
You know?
It's back to that Rex Lex dilemma. Is it power or is it goodness? You know?
Yeah. So the question of whether God exists, actually, see, there's the other word. You know, we talk about
what does exist? God,
what do you mean by exist? Yeah. So does, for example, there was, you've probably heard of this in just recent years, some people made up this character on the internet called Slender Man. Yes. Have you heard about this?
Yes.
Okay. So it was this horror concept of a spirit that haunts children and has these real long arms, and they made graphics and, you know, made up stories about and all this kind of thing.
Even pictures, they've fabricated pictures as well.
Yeah, yeah. So he's become kind of a boogeyman in the popular culture. And now, unfortunately, there have been a couple of girls, and I think some other kids have done some things too, who have, you know, done some horrible things, hurt other children, and then when asked, they said the Slender Man made them do it. Now, you know, are they just saying that to get out of something? Do they really believe it? Let's assume for the moment that some of these younger kids might really believe it. You're talking now about an entity in the popular culture. You could almost say it's like a mimetic sort of construct, a collection of memes or thoughts and ideas that move throughout the culture and in a sense have agency because they cause certain things to happen. Now, everybody has their own choice, of course, but if you're talking about causation, there was another lady who was recently sent to jail because she sent texts to her boyfriend and led to him committing suicide. Now, that's an example of a person and a person. No doubts at all that she exists and no doubts at all that he exists, and yet she was held responsible even though it was his choice to take his own life because of the thing she did to him. So if she's responsible for that, then the Slender Man is kind of the same, you know, has this influence over. Now, I doubt there's this mimetic construct in our culture has a first person experience, like a person like we do. But there is a sense in which the concept of something can be said to exist. Or say, for example, a much nicer example, Santa Claus. No, you know, Santa Claus could be said to exist in the sense that that the character represents these ideals of charity or giving. And, you know, it wasn't too long ago that we would often personify concepts, Lady Liberty and what's the other one with the blindfold? Justice with the blindfold and the scales. This was a very common thing to do all the way, even Uncle Sam, all the way up until maybe the 20th century, we kind of stopped doing it at that point. But it was extremely common to personify concepts, and nobody thought that Uncle Sam was a real entity. Nobody thought that.
We still do that in our superheroes. At superheroes, they're simply a construct of the hero, or in some cases, the villain.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, well, an interesting point.
Yeah, and there's many people that aspire to be Superman or Batman or whatever the superhero is. And so that's a natural thing for us. When we look up in the sky and look at a cloud, we instantly see animals and people's faces and things like that. We have this biological ability that's tightly honed so that we can distinguish the enemy in the bush. But unfortunately, that also means that we project humanness onto things, mm-hmm. not just, you know, things that we see, but things we think we see. And then there's the fact that we do that with concepts. We embody concepts with reality. A concept, you can take any kind of concept that is an abstract concept. Lady Liberty. Well, Lady Liberty doesn't really exist. We have the Statue of Liberty. That is a statue that
a physical
object. But Lady Liberty or Lady Sophia or Lady Wisdom. Mm. These things are concepts, but
they're ways for us to relate to something.
And that's exactly,
because we are persons.
Exactly. We
want to personify things to relate. I think what this comes back to is mindfulness. If we are mindful about the way we're approaching these concepts, they could be constructive. You could say, well, what sorts of ideals and values and even personified characters do I want to associate with? We're kind of approaching what we mentioned before in the naturalistic paganism episode about the naturalistic approach to gods and deities as metaphors and archetypes. So there could be a means there, but you have to be very, very mindful because, like you said, it can lead to dark places.
Well, and that, you know, that I guess is my take on it. And, you know, when it comes to the idea of God, to me, the word God is too loaded with connotations that other people won't understand. So if somebody asks me, do I believe in God? I will answer, I am a non-theist. I don't believe in a theistic God. I don't believe a God who is transcendent and immanent. How can you be in the world but not in the world? You're outside of the world yet in the world. How can you be both, you know, and yet be not both? It's both and it's like the concept itself has incongruities. In other words, it doesn't make sense.
And I found that.
And you go into other issues. You go into the problem of evil. You know, the whole problem of evil can be summed up very simply. If an all-powerful God exists, he can eliminate evil. If an all-good God exists, he would eliminate evil. Yet evil is not eliminated. Therefore, there's not an all-powerful, all-good God.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way I like to respond is I like to respond with another positive, like, it's not a direct answer to their question, but it kind of answers it. And it answers it in a way that maintains the emphasis that I want to maintain about myself. So if they say, do you believe in God? My answer is, I believe in goodness. I believe in truth. I believe in beauty. I believe in helping one another. I believe in compassion And, you know, I talk about the things I believe in, and sometimes that matches pretty close to what they think God embodies, and we can meet eye to eye on that. But what that does is it keeps me in the category of talking about what I do believe. And that way I'm not just the absence of somebody else's worldview. I'm me. I'm talking about my values and my spirituality. And
you do know what most atheists would say to you about that, but that's a cop-out.
Well, people who use the word atheist, people who use the word atheist describe themselves, they really want to make that point, that I do not believe in your God. Yeah. And to me, it's...
unhelpful. It's unhelpful.
It's unhelpful, but it's also not important. It's not like I'm trying to do it for some PC reason, or I'm trying to... Right. I'm shy about the getting into the, you know, being upfront about it or anything like that. It's that... It's not really how I, when I think to myself, I don't think of myself with the word atheist, even though technically that may be true because I lack theism. But
see, I would say
other words that describe what I do believe much more. Like, I don't think of myself as without or a this or non that. I think of myself as what I am.
Yeah, but and that's why most will call themselves humanists to do the positive.
Yeah.
The problem I have with atheism is literally it means no God. Atheism, no God. Now, my question is, do you know everything? No. What you don't know might be God, so you can't say no God.
Yeah.
That's why, for me, atheism, literally taken, is undefensible. Non-theism, which says non-belief in theism, says I just don't believe because there's not enough good reasons to believe it. There's not enough good evidence.
Yeah.
It's a different...
It doesn't imply that you also believe there is no God.
Right.
It just says
the minute
that you make a judgment on it.
But the minute that you make a positive assertion, then the burden of proof shifts to you. Now you have to prove a negative. And it's impossible to prove a negative in most cases. There might be a teapot on Pluto. You can't prove it's not there. Therefore, it's there. And that's how most people argue with God. But the problem with the whole God question is it's not a rational question. People do not come to the belief in God through reason. They come through it with that feeling, that intuition that something greater exists. Mm-hmm. That's where they... And you could argue to your blue in the face, they will not change that belief. That's why I don't believe it's helpful. Yeah. What I believe is helpful is helping them to distinguish the feeling that there's something greater than myself and the interpretation of that feeling that this is the theistic God, that this is this is Zeus, this is Allah, this is Elohim, this is and naming it. Because that's what they're born in a culture where that feeling is given that label.
And that's something that we as spiritual naturalists have. I mean, you couldn't necessarily say this about all atheists, but those who are spiritual naturalists, whether they call themselves that or not, are people that can identify with those theists who have had those that sense of the sacred or that profound experience or that transformative epiphany.
Yes, the union, union with reality.
Yeah, that
moving. I've experienced it.
We've had that.
Yes.
Both you and I have had that. We know what we're what we're talking about, and we've had that.
Yes.
And we have that in common with a lot of people who call themselves theists or who call themselves Christian. And so we can talk about that. And that's where the humility comes in. You know, it's not making more claims than what we really know just because we really, really want to know more about it or we want to get a handle on it. So your mind wants to get a handle on it. It wants to put your little words around it, and your framings and all that kind of stuff. And we try to resist doing that out of humility, which is a totally different way to come at non-theism than somebody who's out there to disprove other people's beliefs. They're doing the skeptic thing.
Yeah, and that again is the important thing is we understand the feeling of that mystical feeling of union and communion with reality. Mm-hmm. But we also understand that man has made interpretations of that, systems of belief. And these systems of belief may or may not correspond to the reality of that feeling. But in many societies, that's the only explanation for the feeling is it's God.
Yeah.
And when you start studying pantheism and you start studying the experience of pantheism, you realize, wait a minute, that union and communion is with reality, and reality is nature, and we're having a union and communion with nature. And if you think about it, we are nature. Mm-hmm. And why that experience is so awesome is we're coming back home. We found the heart. The heart has found its home, and that home is nature. It's where you were born. From dust you will be, from dust you came, from dust you'll return. We are nature. And when we return to nature, that's when the experience happens. You get up on that mountain, you look over the beautiful mountain, the awe, the tinglings that go on in your body, you just feel home.
And it can be a gateway to get beyond that egotistical, narrow self as well.
Yeah.
To a larger, broader view.
Yeah, it breaks the ego. That's why the experience happens. We're in a shell. We're in an ego shell. Everything we do, think, and say is all about us. The whole entire universe revolves around each of us individually. That's the selfishness. That's the ego. And that can only be broken out of through spiritual practice, by getting those moments of epiphany, of a greater awareness that there is something greater, that something greater is nature.
That's start to really piece together and investigate what is it that creates that experience and how can I use that experience to transform myself.
Yep.
You know, another thing you said about what we call ourselves. Another reason I don't call myself an atheist primarily as a label is that to me the question isn't as important. In a way, I'm kind of dissing our whole topic today by saying this, but I don't really believe the question of God is as important as most people believe it is, and I don't even believe that it's as important as they think it is. So, like, for example, if you were to ask somebody, let's say that you found this box and you could look in the box and it would reveal ultimate truth to you, all truth of everything. And you look in this box and it tells you everything about whether there's an afterlife, whether there's a God, whether all this stuff. And let's say that you found out that the scenario of there being a personified supernatural God in heaven and you live on there forever, that scenario wasn't true. Let's say, just pretend for the moment, you look in there and you discover that it wasn't true. And what you do discover is one of two things. And I'm going to give you two different scenarios, and then you tell me which one would you prefer to have found out was the truth. Under one scenario, there is a loving, powerful God. I don't know if I say all powerful, but there's a loving, powerful God. He's existed for all time, and he created the universe, and he's supernatural, and he's intelligent. He created all of us. But when you die, you die. You are part of the natural universe God created. You stay in that little bubble, and you die. That's it. But God is there, and he's real. Or scenario number two is you discover that there's no God. God isn't real. It's just a figment of people's. But when you die, you go to this heavenly blissful realm and you live forever. So my guess is that most people would prefer, whether they admit it or not, they would prefer, if they had to choose between those two scenarios, they would prefer the second one. And I think that really what makes most people really care about the God, no God question is because God is part of a larger story in which they get to live forever. And it's really boils down to their immortality. of they themselves individually, and you know, those they love, and seeing them again. I think God is just the vehicle by which that happens. I don't think most people really care whether God exists or not. It's just that he is so synonymously attached to that whole scenario where you get to exist on forever. And that's what makes people care about the issue of God.
I would say that it's probably a combination. I think that the afterlife, death is by far one of the greatest fears that people have. Facing their own immortality, imagining what it's like to cease to exist, or to end up in heaven or hell or whatever the belief system is that they hold. But I think that would not be enough in itself, because you have afterlives in, the idea of nirvana, ultimate nirvana in Buddhism, which is an afterlife without a God. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think you need God to necessarily get an afterlife. But I think that definitely fuels the fire. I think there's also an aspect that we feel like if it's just us and there is no God, we're unimportant. I think a personal God gives people significance. Significance that maybe their parents or society or friends or what don't give them. If God is looking after me, when I was a Christian,
he has a plan for you.
He has a plan for me, and you know, my life matters. And you take God away, life then doesn't matter. Hmm.
I think that's why Buddhists place such a prominence on the present moment, because they're trying to get you to be in the present. Because if you're in the present, then you're not looking at life as some kind of like series of steps that you're going to achieve this eventual goal of having gone down in the annals of history and have a legacy, and that it's all for some end purpose. Instead, you're thinking of each moment to moment as the valuable experience.
I'll have to disagree with you. I think Buddhists are in fact aiming for nirvana. I don't know that the Buddha was that concerned about them getting to final nirvana as in present nirvana. That is, the Buddha reached nirvana when he meditated and he was what they call enlightened. He was awakened. That's why he's called the awakened one. That happened that moment. I think that was what the Buddha was worried about. But as the tradition grew, more and more people got concerned about the afterlife. They wanted to get out of the cycle of rebirth.
And oh, sure. There's a supernatural Buddhism that grew after that all throughout. I would even say if you're just counting bodies, if you're just counting number of people, that is the majority of Buddhism.
Yeah, they're looking for that ultimate goal. And I think that personally, I think that one of the difficulties is the idea of enlightenment as the final goal. So I don't see it that way. If you go back to the Pali, the word is bodhi, awakening. If you look at it as awakening and not awakened, awakening is a process that begins but has no ending.
And that is a perfectly acceptable concept within modern naturalism, this idea of ever more understanding, ever more enlightenment. And that way, enlightenment starts to match similar to the Western enlightenment, as you kind of see the overlap there. And that makes perfect sense within a naturalistic, spiritual naturalist practice, that you have an enlightenment as a concept of an ever ongoing gradation.
And that to me is the great thing about when you look at that, then you don't have people becoming fully enlightened and they stop growing and they start teaching others their particular version. Rather, they keep the humility that they're still growing, that they're still expanding, they're still awakening to greater depths of reality. Because nobody is perfect.
Once somebody we start calling these people perfect gurus or whatever, then you start having all of that negative stuff coming in of that happened.
Ego rushes in that kind of situation. I am the one. Yeah. I am Neo. the awakened one within
the movement. In fact, I think what we have to do, because you and I both, we're kind of in the realm of teaching, we're this very program and our writings and all that. What we have to do, I think, is think of our teaching as a part of our learning. And I've felt like, you know, after you learn for a while, you begin to learn more by then teaching it to others. It's part of your own learning because you start to learn from your own students or readers or whatever you want to call it as well.
Yeah. They've said teaching is learning twice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
And I like that saying.
Well, there's, you know, so I think you and I, you know, we both probably frame things very similar. We have similar influences in our own practice. I personally don't use God talk in my personal practice. I am always just, you know, as a representative of SNS, I'm always out there trying to make sure that there is a space and make it clear that there is a way for a naturalist to have God, deity practice, whatever you want to call it, and they understand what that means to them. I don't use it for a lot of the same reasons you say about, you know, it can be misunderstood. You might end up causing more miscommunication. But I also don't use it because it's just not what I relate to personally. To me, the impersonal concepts of Tao or Logos or things like that, those make a lot more sense to me with what I understand about scientific naturalism.
Well, and that human proclivity to take things and project humanity onto it. I mean, that's a common thing that we do. We take a car and, you know, we have a car and we call it Betsy or something. We personalize it. Well, it's an inanimate object. It's an it. It's not a she or, you know, might be Frank, if you're a female and you want to call it Frank, you know, but we do that. We personalize things. We anthropomorphize. And the difficulty is we're so prone to that, you know, I grew up in pretty much a nominal Christian environment, and then I entered into the ministry. And so everything was Christianity for most of my adult life. And then I discovered the Tao. And to me, that made more sense. It wasn't some kind of reflection of who I was. It was what it is in itself.
It's just basically the way things work, the way of nature.
Well, and think of it. Do you really think that God has, what makes a man? Does God have those particular physical aspects? Well, of course not. Then why call God a man, you know? What happens is, and within the Wiccan community, they have the goddess and the god to try to balance out that imbalance that's been within the dominant theistic religion systems. It's been male-oriented, male-run, and women have been second-class citizens. And it's been a way to control women. And that's the difficulty with whenever you take a meme, a concept, and you anthropomorphize it, you end up creating more difficulties. And for me, that's one of the reasons I tried to stay away from the God talk, because it's hard to say I believe in, you know, God without instantly being the male God of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism.
Interesting.
You know, you instantly have to
take into account the culture in which you're operating.
It's so much easier to say, I believe in the Tao. Easier to say and much clearer, not perfectly clear, obviously, because the Tao is the Tao of nature, the way, the rhythm of nature, the way nature does. But, you know, it instantly gets me away from the whole mess of tangled webs of definitions when I don't use that kind of God talk.
And, you know, another option could be, and a lot of humanists do this, a lot of atheists do this, just talk about things in scientific terms. But the reason I don't do that is because there is this sense of the sacred. There is a spiritual practice. There is a way of framing and picturing things in a way that's more poetic, more intuitive, that's not the way you would phrase things if you're trying to build a rocket ship.
Right.
And that's an important human connectivity thing. And so I want people to understand when I tell them what I believe, that to me it is valuable and sacred and meaningful and moving. And I want them to understand by the language I use how central that is and how important that is in my life. And so you just don't get that with dry technical language.
Right, right.
I think it's we're about at the end of our time. I want to make sure we mention a few things. So there's some interesting, if you're just getting into spiritual naturalism, hopefully that helps explain a little bit about how many of us look at that kind of stuff. There's a book by Loyal Rue called Religion is Not About God. That might be one good option. There's also a book by Lloyd Gearing called Christianity Without God. And that's really interesting because he talks about the Christian wisdom streams and a way to approach Christianity without a literal God. Michael Dowd, we mentioned earlier, he has an interesting lexicon, the way he talks about God as reality and science as revelation, and getting right with God is getting right with reality. And then there's, let's see, I think I had one more. Oh, yeah. Complex systems theorist or scientist Stuart Kaufman wrote a book called Reinventing the Sacred. And he suggests a God that is basically the innate creative capacity of the universe. The tendency, it's that thing that goes opposite entropy, where when you have energy applied to a system, there tends to be this increasing complexity, life and what have you. And that we could look at that as a kind of a God, at least certain aspects. So there's all these different takes on it, different framings. We mentioned the naturalistic pagans. And so a lot of different things for you to explore and think about what relates to you. And the fact that it relates to you or not is important in and of itself. Because if you're talking about a practice that's going to be transformative, it has to relate to you for you to have those moving moments and those epiphanies. You want to add anything else before we wrap up, Jay?
Oh, I was just, I'm actually surprisingly, I'm reading a book called Philosophers Without God.
Oh.
And actually, it's an interest. First, the first part is dealing with more of the, how people left or dealt with their particular religion, whether it's Jewish or, and one of them actually got into Buddhism is how he ended up leaving, which is similar to my case. But it's kind of an interesting progression to see how these different people struggled with the different questions. And the one that I was just reading was dealing with the struggle that he had when he was reading C.S. Lewis. And when C.S. Lewis was basically trying to answer the question, if the only way to be saved is through Jesus Christ, then what about all these people who didn't hear? And C.S. Lewis said, basically, well, maybe God has another way. And he said, well, if it's another way, then that's pretty superficial.
Hmm.
And that's the route similar to what you're talking about. The question is superficial then. It becomes superficial if it doesn't matter. And you make big issues out of things that aren't big issues, because ultimately the way to actually live in the world is to live in the world and to learn from the world.
I would say it matters, but it matters on a different basis. It matters for different reasons and in different ways. It's like the things that matter are different.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the best way of saying it. The things that matter are different and for different reasons.
This has really been great. And, you know, I always feel this way at the end of our conversations, that they're really just the tiniest springboard to what can be a lifetime of discovery. So Anyway, thank you to our audience for joining us and for listening. And we're going to wrap this up here today. And keep a lookout for our next episode. And if you haven't listened to our previous ones, go to our website at spiritualnaturalistsociety.org and check it out. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.
This program was sponsored by the Spiritual Naturalist Society. Learn more and become a member at spiritualnaturalistsociety.org. Our music was composed by John Clemisrud. Jay Forrest is our technical director. Please share our program and join us next time on Spiritual Naturalism Today.